Start over. Okay, my name's Rahula Janowski, and I'll be moderating tonight's event. And I wanted to, first of all, thank the Oakland Unitarian Church for giving us the space for the event. And I want to thank the Occupy Oakland Events Committee for sponsoring the event. And I want to thank all of you for coming. I'm going to make a couple comments and then describe the format of the evening, and then we'll get to the panelists. So I just wanted to say that, you know, from looking at history, that movements, as they start to grow, often encounter internal divisions and differences. And the ruling elite is very skilled and practiced at using those divisions and exploiting them, and using a divide and rule strategy. And the Occupy movement, the movement of 99%, has already had a pretty enormous impact. I've seen it coming up. I've seen the language of the 99% and the 1% coming up in places like the San Francisco Board of Supervisors when they were talking about a housing project for rich people on the waterfront. I've seen it in movie reviews. There's a new Occupy-related meme on the internet practically every day. And the dialogue on a national level has changed. And all of that, and we're just getting started, right? Right? So it's not surprising, given that growth, that there are divisions and there are differences coming up within the Occupy movement. There's people coming from all different sectors of the 99%, with all kinds of different backgrounds, experiences, politics, philosophies. You know, there's a lot going on. So I think when those differences come up, it's an opportunity. You know, it's an opportunity to deepen, to build, to grow. But if we don't have dialogue about those differences, then we miss the opportunity. So I'm super excited about tonight. We're going to have a really good dialogue about one of the differences that has come up within the Occupy movement. And I just wanted to say that having that dialogue will strengthen us and make it harder for the ruling elite to exploit that difference against us. On the panel tonight, we have people who advocate for strategic nonviolence, and we have people on the panel who advocate for a diversity of tactics. Everyone's here because we are part of this movement. We want to see this movement succeed beyond our wildest dreams. We want to see real, substantial, radical change happen. And everyone is here because of that. And so the panelists are committed to having a respectful dialogue amongst each other. And I just want to ask you all to do that as well. There's going to be a lot of time for Q&A. And I want to say, please, you know, if something inspires you, definitely feel free to, you know, to respond to that. But we actually don't want booing and hissing going on if you hear something that you don't agree with. You can certainly ask questions about those things or point them out in a respectful way during the Q&A. Is everyone good with that? Yeah? Great. All right, so we're going to do introductions. The way that the flow of the evening is going to go is each panelist is going to introduce themselves, and then we're going to go back, and each panelist is going to speak for 6 minutes about their perspective. And then we're going to have a Q&A between the panelists, where the panelists can ask each other questions, and then we're going to have Q&A from the audience. So the entire program is about an hour, hour and a half?
Two and a half hours.
And I believe that the bathrooms are that way, kind of go down the hall and to the right if you need them. So do you want to start down here maybe? Okay.
Hi, I'm Starhawk. I'm a writer and author. Some of my books are there in the back, including my new one called The Empowerment Manual, which is about working in horizontal collaborative groups. I've been involved in political and social movements since the 60s, from the anti-war through the feminist movement, earth-based spirituality, many anti-war movements, actually. I keep cycling over and over again. And many years in the anti-globalization, or I prefer to call it global justice movement, I do a lot of training in nonviolent direct action and have worked in groups that both have a commitment to strategic nonviolence and a framework of diversity of tactics. So really glad to be here tonight, glad we're having this dialogue.
Good evening, I'm Joshua Shepherd. I'm from Sassoon City, California. Just in the North Bay, I'm a 6-year Navy veteran. I worked on Tomahawk Block 4 missile systems, as well as the SM-3 missile system, as a computer tech on guided missile destroyers and cruisers. I've since had a change of heart. I'm a member of Iraq Vets Against the War, as well as Veterans for Peace. I'm also a friend of Scott Olson's, and I was that guy in the sailor outfit when he got hit. So you may have seen my silhouette around. I'm here, and I'll be advocating on behalf of us nonviolence folks. Thanks.
Good evening. My name is Phil Lawson. I'm a United Methodist clergy, a pastor of some 60 years. I started out in the journey to nonviolence as a 15-year-old member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and learned my nonviolence through Byler Ruskin and George Hauser, and A.J. Mustey, not through Dr. King. My first engagement in nonviolent direct action was in 1950. I've been working in justice movements since that time, including gender equality and more recently Black Alliance for Just Immigration, and I'm the organizer of the National Council of Elders.
Good evening, everyone. Let's try that one more time. Good evening, everyone! Is this not loud enough?
Oh, it's too loud. How's this? Can folks up there hear us? All right. So my name is Kazu. I'm honored to be a part of this discussion tonight. I'm the program coordinator for an organization called the Peace Development Fund, which is a foundation that supports grassroots organizing. And I'm also board president of an organization called Courage that works with gang-involved youth through nonviolence, legal advocacy, and restorative justice work. But tonight I'm here mostly in my capacity as a Kingian nonviolence trainer. Kingian nonviolence is a framework that was developed out of the teachings of Dr. Martin Luther King and was really the organizing model and the strategy behind the civil rights movement.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
My name is Matthew Edwards. Is the volume okay? Great. Give you some context to who I am. I was one of the first conscientious objectors from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I refused deployment to Afghanistan, and I told them that I wasn't going to go to Iraq. They locked me in a dungeon for 6 months. They beat me, they tortured me, and they broke my hip. They finally kicked me out. Since that time, I've spent the last almost 10 years, 8 years, working with whatever community I find myself in, typically around issues of anti-militarism, but over the past few years, it's been around anti-police brutality work as well as community empowerment work. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Hello, my name is Melissa. I was asked to be on this panel by Matt. I am very excited to be on this panel with all of you. I am a person who works with children. I am a self-proclaimed flagrant supporter of human rights on the left and a very shameless anti-authoritarian, pro-feminist, anti-police violence activist. I'm here to talk about my opinions regarding the Occupy movement, in particular about diversity of tactics. Thanks.
Hello. Can you hear me? My name is Paolo. I'm from Santa Cruz, California, and while I'm a bit hesitant to give my activist credentials, just so you can have some idea of what I care about, I'll name a few things I've been involved in over the years. I've been involved in a tree sit in Santa Cruz, California against the development of, I've been involved in a tree sit in Santa Cruz, California against the development of a biotechnology facility. I've been involved in the struggle against the building of an interstate highway, Interstate 69 in Indiana. I've helped done legal support in Minneapolis, Minnesota for those arrested at the Republican National Convention protests. And I've also been involved in Occupy Oakland here, as well as many other struggles over the past few years.
Hello? Good? Cool. Hi, everybody. My name is Sean O'Brien. I grew up in the Northeast. I've lived out here in the Bay Area now for about 7 or 8 years. I was raised by a feminist racial justice advocate and an Irish socialist that struggled for Irish independence in the 80s. I've mentioned my folks because I think it made me who I am a lot. And then my experience over the last 3 years has been with anarchist infrastructure projects, mainly unconventional action in the Bay, as well as the new social center called The Holdout that we're opening up here in West Oakland. But on the other side of things, I've also worked with Greenpeace for on and off for about 4 or 5 years and have done other work with nonviolent direct action groups such as DASW. So I feel like I have a pretty balanced approach to this topic, and I'm hoping that we can come out all respecting each other and have all of our opinions challenged. So thanks.
Thanks, everyone. And actually, Sean, hold on to that microphone. You're going to be the first panelist to speak. So are you ready?
Yeah.
Great.
All right. If you weren't tired of hearing me talk, then I'll continue. So to elaborate a little bit on who I am, because one of the things that I hope to do in the next few minutes is to challenge some of the stereotypes or notions about who supports the idea of diversity of tactics. I come from a place of incredible respect and appreciation for the effectiveness of civil disobedience and nonviolent direct action. As I said, I worked with Greenpeace for a number of years and have been a dedicated member of a number of different nonviolent direct actions with Greenpeace, Direct Action to Stop the War, and a number of other groups. I've worked as a police liaison. I've worked as a nonviolence trainer. At different actions, I've had some pretty intense things happen, like having guns pointed in my face or having angry security members threaten to cut my climbing rope while I was 20 stories up on a building. I mention these things not really to like brag about things that I've been a part of, but to try and let people know that in all of these I remain dedicated to the principles of nonviolence that I felt like were appropriate for that action. I share this to try and break down that stereotype of who we call, of what we call people that, you know, that support a diversity of tactics, and kind of break down this idea that it's a bunch of angry, aggro men who are unconvinced of the effectiveness of nonviolent action. The media has helped this portrayal a bit, but to be honest, a number of people within our anarchist or radical political scenes have also, I think, contributed to that stereotype. I think people who discard civil disobedience as ineffective or weak or just kind of silly are actually doing the movement a disservice as well. To me, the main word that's important in diversity of tactics is the first one, diversity. And it means that all things that might be effective or strategically appropriate are on the table. So while I do advocate for diversity of tactics, I'm also frustrated with what that term has kind of come to mean within our movement. So I want to challenge my comrades in the radical community to start sincerely looking at all options with an equal amount of respect. And many times, peaceful actions actually do make the most sense and will be the most strategic. That being said, I also challenge those who profess an exclusively nonviolent movement to put aside the moralistic approach to this issue and to start talking about what's effective and not effective, and not talking about what's moral and immoral or right and wrong, because I think that's the wrong conversation to have. In terms of that, I think one of the main problems with an exclusively quote-unquote nonviolent movement is that it immediately requires a definition of what is violent and what is not. So this, unfortunately, is why we end up in this never-ending conversation about what's violent, what's not violent, and not what's effective and what's not effective. It's often, unfortunately, when a movement becomes nonviolent, that definition is often the lowest common denominator or the most narrow definition of what violence means. And the problem with this is that there's a number of things that exist in that gray area, right? So that gray area includes things like self-defense when you're being attacked, right? Throwing tear gas canisters back at police when you have them fired upon you. Even to more complicated things like industrial sabotage that some people might consider very violent, but other people might not, right? So all these are examples of things that tend to get thrown out the window immediately when a movement is exclusively nonviolent. The danger in silencing those alternative ideas is that it doesn't actually stop them from happening. Okay, if a movement considers itself nonviolent and pushes out people who want to do anything that movement considers violent, it doesn't actually stop those tactics from happening. It just eliminates any process for accountability or for discussion after an action, and instead has them happen just kind of in this scattered orientation that really isn't focused at all. So I think there's two examples of that. I think the night of November 2nd is a good example, where a number of different things happened that night, including an occupation, including a march that targeted a number of banks, and then including things like lighting barricades on fire and fighting back against police. After that night, the discussion didn't turn to which of those things were effective when they happened and which weren't. The discussion turned to whether violence was wrong, whether it was moral, or whether it was wrong and immoral. And that's an example of why that discussion is so detrimental, I think, to moving forward. And so another example historically is Nelson Mandela speaking on why South Africa had an armed wing in their movement, and he said, it was as much to focus the anger and militancy of people that were legitimately upset, to take that anger and focus it in strategic places. And if they didn't have an armed wing, then these things would have happened all over the place, and it actually wouldn't have been as focused. So I think that's an argument for it. The last point I'll make is I don't actually think there's an example historically of a time when nonviolence alone has brought major revolutionary structural changes. I'm still waiting for that example. I want to read a quote real quick from Martin Luther King's Nonviolence, the Only Road to Freedom. He says, "The American racial revolution has been a revolution to get in rather than to overthrow. We want to share in the American economy, the housing market, the educational system, and the social opportunities. The goal itself indicates that a social change in America must be nonviolent." So my question to people is, what is our goal? Is our goal in this Occupy movement to be included back in this broken system? Is it to participate in the housing market? Is it to lower taxes? Is it to be in a little less debt and own our house and cars again, like we did in the 90s? Or is it to actually address, tear down this corrupt system and build something in its place? If it's just to get back in, then I agree, nonviolence can get us there. If it's to tear down this entire structure and build something better, then it's only gonna take us so far, and we're gonna come to a point where it's not as effective, and it's not gonna be enough. So, thank you.
Reverend Lawson? Mm. Okay. Do you want this one?
Well, let me begin by talking about nonviolence as I have grown to know it in my lifetime and to try to live it. Number one, nonviolence is not a tactic or a strategy. Nonviolence is a way of life. It's a way, as Dr. King and Gandhi talked about it and created the science of nonviolence. Nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. It's active nonviolent resistance. It is not pacifism. It is not passive resistance. It's assertive, spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. It always persuades the opponent of the justice of the cause. Number two, nonviolence seeks to win friendships and understanding. The end result of nonviolence is redemption and reconciliation. The purpose of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. Therefore, I contend that nonviolence is the most consistent way that the Occupy movement had talked about what it wants to do. It wants to transform this nation. You see, the end result, the opposite of oppression and domination and slavery, is not freedom to do what you want to do. That's not the opposite of slavery and domination. The opposite of domination and slavery is community. Community, people together. Freedom from domination and slavery is a necessary prerequisite so that we might enter into community. If a woman is oppressed by violence of her husband, she cannot enter into community with her husband until she's free from the violence. Once she's free, then she can negotiate what it means to live in community. We haven't even begun in our own nation the process of helping people to be free of all those things that oppress them. So we cannot begin to move into a nation, of a community of beloved people until all of us are free and able to negotiate how we're going to live together as a people. Let me move on here. Nonviolence seeks not to defeat human beings, but to defeat injustice, the white privileged male is a victim who believes that he is better than others. He has grown up with a false sense of superiority, in the same sense that African Americans and people of color have grown up with a false sense of inferiority. All in this society are victims of the domination and oppression. Nonviolent holds that voluntary suffering can educate and transform the nation. Willingly accepting the consequences of our actions, willingly accepting suffering. One black man in the Dr. King movement said it this way: I will let them kick me and kick me until they have kicked all the hatred out of themselves and into my body, where I will transform it into love for those who kicked me. Nonviolence is a way of life for courageous, strong people. Nonviolence chooses love, not hate, instead of hatred. Nonviolence resists violence of the spirit, of the body, and of things. I grew up in a situation of Jim Crow. There was a poem that enabled me to know nonviolence that I learned there. Let me lay it on you. They drew a circle that shut me out. Dumb, heretic, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took them in. The African American community, in its struggles throughout for freedom in the United States and for the building of a beloved community, made two very important decisions. They first of all decided that once they won their freedom from slavery, that this would be the place in which they would hammer out what it means to be and to live in community. That we would do this next door to the sons and daughters of slave owners. That this is the place that we will build the beloved community. We will not in any shape or form convince large numbers of the African American community that violence is a way to freedom and community, since violence is the way the domination system uses to impose its way and to support the status quo. Violence will never be able to set me free and help me to live in community with you and with others. Thank you.
Hi again. I want to speak for a moment about the facts of our current movement. I hate to say it, but it's actually a violent movement. Let me explain why. There's racism in our movement. There's a lot of racism in our movement. I would just like to have everyone look around for a moment at who's next to you, behind you, in front of you. Right? Okay, I'm gonna leave that unsaid. There's some classism in our movement. There really is. I don't know if you've been down to the Occupy encampments, any of the Occupy encampments. You can tell that there's difference in class, and I think it's fair to say that out loud. There's homophobia. Mm-hmm. The fact that there are safe spaces that have been fought for, prove that. And there's patriarchy, lots of it. And I think it's fair to voice that too. Now those are all extremely violent structural forms. And those forms are wrapped around our movement like a cancer. So to say that we have a non-violent movement is false. Our movement has some violence in it. It's a little bit higher than the surface. It's hard to see, but it's there. Our movement's also privileged. Sometimes that privilege has to come from experience. Maybe you've been around for a while, you know everybody, so you kind of get put at the front in terms of stack. Maybe you start a committee and end up leading it. The hierarchy of information is a dangerous, violent form. So I'd like us all just to pause for a moment and just reflect. This movement has some deep elements of violence. Now, we come to the discussion of tactics. I agree that nonviolence can be a way of life, and I would ask that you keep your way of life to yourself and let me live my life how I want to live it. And I will do the same for you. I'd like to turn to our collective memories here. I'm going to talk about Oscar Grant. I'm going to talk about the Oakland General Assembly, and I'm going to talk about the night after the first eviction, when we saw that street fight on the news before the news feed was cut. Who here participated in any of the riots in the Oscar Grant movement? There were four of them. Anybody? Okay. So I only ask because I don't want to speak to a group of people who already know. But let me say, a week after the murder of Oscar Grant, nothing had been done. There had been rallies, there had been press releases, but nothing structurally had been done. And then, people who were not in this room went out into the streets and they smashed shit. And they set some stuff on fire. And they fought the cops. And 100 people got arrested. All but two got charges put on them. And those charges were plead out. But over the course of almost 2 years, There were three other riots. The cop who killed Oscar Grant served a little bit of jail time. He would have served no jail time had people not gone out into the streets and demanded vengeance. It was violence, and I'm actually okay with that. Second point, during the General Assembly, there was a disruptive individual. I'm going to leave him nameless. But over the course of three nights, there was a steady progression. He was de-escalated each time. He'd come, maybe suffering from some sort of mental situation, maybe he was on drugs, alcohol, I didn't stop to ask him, but he was intense, he was aggressive, and he was calmed down using nonviolent tactics. It was great. And then he came back the next night, and again, he was talked down. And then on the third night, he pulled a knife, and he started to aggress towards people. And the response was someone grabbed a 2x4 and hit him on the back of the head. He got knocked out. He was pulled from the camp. Medics checked him to make sure he was alive. He was, and that was the end of it. He didn't come back. He wasn't welcome there anymore. Now, I wonder, in our nonviolent movement, if someone hadn't gotten up and smacked him on the back of the head, would the cops have been called? I want to think that actually that probably would have happened. And then this poor guy would have been thrown into the violent penitentiary system, maybe beaten by police. At the very least, he would have been, again, once again, thrown into this machine, this violent machine. And instead, people took it upon themselves to use a little bit of violence to end a situation that needed to be ended. And I applaud that. And finally, the reason why people were able to reoccupy the second time is because they fought the police. Not with guns, not with firebombs, with their bodies, and sometimes rocks. And do you know what? Those images were spectacular. Not because they were super cool, violent images, but because it showed people resisting. Resisting in a way that made sense, and resisting in a way that people could understand. So the plaza was reoccupied, and it lasted until it was, again, destroyed by the cops. So I'd just like to say, one, actually look at the situation. There are so many different forms of structural violence that we need to confront, and we are arguing about tactics that have been proven time and time again to actually get some results. Thank you.
Hello again. So for me, part of this conversation is a little bit out of context, because I'm sorry, I got a big voice, I know. Tactics get you closer to a goal. As a movement, I feel like we haven't articulated what our goal is, so we're talking about tactics a little bit out of context. So I would urge this movement that as we go into the winter, to not always focus on actions, but doing the legwork that is required to make an action successful. So that's the first thing. Regarding diversity of tactics, I also believe in diversity of tactics. There's a lot of tactics that we use, nonviolent and otherwise. Mm-hmm. But without some sort of baseline and some principles to ground us, I mean, it could mean, as someone at the General Assembly one night said, does that mean we would endorse someone kidnapping, torturing, and murdering the children of corporate executives? None of us on this table, I'm sure, would advocate for that. But without some common understandings, we don't know how far we're allowed to take it, right? There's this moral relativism, the moral ambiguity. And I would argue that this is about morals, that this struggle is about the morals and about the values of our society. I also want to talk a little bit about police violence and dig into our history a little bit further back than Oscar Grant. The Bloody Sunday March in Selma, where about 650 marchers were attacked by police. And despite the violence from the police, they were able to maintain the core values that they wanted in the society that they were trying to create. The values of peace, of compassion, of understanding. What happened as a result of the police violence is that 2 days later, that 650 grew to 2,500. And 2 weeks after that, that 2,500 grew to 8,000. What happens when we're able to maintain and represent the values that we want to see in the society it paints a very clear picture of who's right and who's wrong. And that public narrative is a powerful weapon. That public narrative, when we engage in acts of property destruction or whatever it may be, it taints the narrative and it confuses things. So when we saw images of Scott Olsen getting shot in his head, when we saw images of the students at UC Davis getting pepper sprayed, those images, it helped to awaken the moral conscience of the nation. Whereas after the violence of the Oscar Grant rallies and things like that, the public narrative that went out was rioters fight police and things that confuse the public narrative. And so we lose potentially huge amounts of support from the mass public. And without support from the majority, no revolution is really possible. Nonviolence, to me, this is one of the biggest misconceptions of nonviolence, is that we think nonviolence means not being violent. Nonviolence is a whole lot more than that.
Yes, sir.
Nonviolence means taking a stand against violence and taking a stand against injustice and taking a stand against this belief that we can use violence, fear, and intimidation to bring about the changes that we want to see in our society. Right? I mean, that's what the government does. It's what the police, the corporations do. They have this belief that they can just take what they want and use fear and intimidation to get what they want. Nonviolence means taking a stand against that belief. When we talk about diversity of tactics, I want to talk about one of the most powerful tactics that I believe in, which is negotiation. It's what we're doing here tonight, getting to know each other, trying to understand our differences and try to figure out a way to work despite our differences. Negotiation is not a tactic that is respected within this movement right now. There's actually a policy of Occupy Oakland to not negotiate with the city. So when we say the diversity of tactics, we're not being genuine about that either. People have been criticized, people have been called out for trying to negotiate with the city. And I understand that, you know, some people don't think the city is worth negotiating with and this and that. I want to remind us that one of the things that the people considered to be the quote-unquote top of society, what they oftentimes do to all of us is they criminalize us and say, you guys are just a bunch of criminals, hippies, dirty anarchists, whatever, protesters. But we sometimes do the same thing back, and we demonize those at the top, and we say you're just a bunch of imperialists, capitalists, pigs, racists. And so there's no effort at dialogue, and not even an effort made at trying to understand the other person's perspective. In Kingian nonviolence, we believe that whether you agree with the other person, or even if the other person is wrong, you still need to understand their perspective in order to understand the conflict. Mayor Kwan has made some terrible mistakes, but she is not Bull Connor. And I've said this before. We have opportunities to engage with her. You know, people say that Mayor Kwan serves the 1%. Every time we buy a bottle of Coke, we support the 1%. Every time we buy a pack of cigarettes or shop at Target, we support the 1%. So in essence, we're all serving the 1% in some way. That's how this game is made up.
Yes.
So we have to recognize that we're all stuck in this unjust system, and the struggle is not against the 1%. The struggle is not between the 1% and the 99%. The struggle is between the 100% and injustice. So that is our enemy. Violence and injustice is our enemy. And the values that we want to see in the world we want to create has to be reflected in the process of us creating it. If we use violence and intimidation to get what we want, that's what's going to be reflected in the world that we create. And just one more thing is that nonviolence can be powerful, it can be aggressive, it can be assertive, it can be militant. So it is not a passive thing. And I want to end with one quote that Dr. King said, that nonviolence isn't just a refusal to shoot your opponent, it's also a refusal to hate your opponent. Because holding hate and anger and the desire for vengeance, we consider that to be an act of violence that you're doing to yourselves.
Hello. I apologize for not having a super well-polished speech prepared. I came directly from work. I wanted to preface what I was going to talk about, which is the idea of legitimacy, and I'll get to that. How's this? Okay. I'll probably get louder as the minutes go by. One thing that I've heard on both sides of this panel so far is, I've heard a couple of things. One, I keep hearing the mention of violence. Violence is good, nonviolence is great, violence can be useful, it's not useful, and I think that we can stick to talking about violence forever. I do think that the topic of violence can be a very narrowly construed one, and I think that Sean mentioned that in his first statement, and that if we look around the room, we can ask each other, what is violence? And we can look around this room and say, okay, this particular demographic believes that violence is this particular thing. I think that that also stymies us. I think that that keeps us from thinking critically about action, about movement, and about struggle and liberation. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I think that also it's useful to ask ourselves, aside from, okay, the Kingian version of nonviolence, the Gandhian version of nonviolence, which it was mentioned earlier is a science, is a social science, is a spiritual practice. It's really important to not forget that nonviolence, particularly, I'll stick with what I know most of, nonviolence in the so-called civil rights movement in the United States was a very strategic one, okay? It was a strategic one in terms of, okay, if we're gonna think about Kazu's example of diversity of tactics, one being negotiation. The leaders, almost all men in the civil rights movement, negotiated with almost all men for space. They negotiated for the right to march. They negotiated for the military to come into small towns such as Selma and make sure that that police and firefighters couldn't continue to mow people down with fire hoses, get attacked by dogs, etc. Because they knew that, quite honestly, if there was no military, no state intervention, that those things would continue to happen because they had been happening for already half of a century. If you look at the history of sundown towns, okay, if anybody in this room knows what a sundown town is, a sundown town is basically a town where if you are a black person in the early part of the century or the late part of the 19th century, if you're a black person caught in a particular town after sundown, you will be killed. You will be violently, brutally killed. Okay, so this is a history that people when they think about the civil rights movement and they think about nonviolence and they're like, oh, we were coming from this moral high ground. No, it was a very strategic goal. And it wasn't the only thing that won civil rights for black people in this country by any stretch. I'm not gonna continue to talk about this. I just wanna drop that as a little bit of food for thought. I mentioned nonviolence as a strategy because I think that the strategy is to attain legitimacy and to attain not just legitimacy for ourselves, but legitimacy, American mainstream legitimacy. We've heard time and again, you know, let's just look at November 2nd. After the 2nd, there, you know, a barricade burned. Some people took over a building, and that was decried as violent. And the immediate arguments against these types of action, aside from they were violent, was that they were taking away the positive public support that we had worked so hard to get over the last couple of months. I won't deny if that's true, and I won't say if that's true or false. I don't really know. I don't really believe either, to be correct. I think that it's important that I think I outed myself earlier as a radical, as an anti-authoritarian, and I think that this is important for you to know because when I talk about legitimacy, and I'll probably come back to this later on this evening, what I mean to say is that actually the Occupy Oakland movement does not need to ask for legitimacy from the mainstream. That, in fact, the Occupy movement, what I hope soon becomes the decolonized movement, is in fact legitimate. And it is the people who have been reaping the benefits of the capitalist system for so long, who finally are like, holy, oh my God, I lost my house and my iPod, who are finally coming to the forefront to fight. It is those people who need to come to us to say, how do we contribute to a legitimate radical restructuring and radical struggle? And part of that is going to be enforcing a diversity of tactics. Some of us are gonna have to sit in, we're gonna have to teach in, we're gonna have to babysit. Some of us are gonna have to go to work. Some of us are going to have to sabotage trucks. Some of us are actually gonna have to actually shut down Wells Fargo and not symbolically shut it down. I'll just remind people really quickly that it was only about three weeks ago that the UC Berkeley police stated, I'm sure everybody read this quote, I can't remember the woman's name because I don't actually care about the police that much. This woman stated that in fact linking arms was a form of violence, people. That linking arms is a form of violence. So again, Kazu, to answer something that you said, I think that it is important that we do continue dialogue, and I think that it is important that we continue to work within the community, especially in Oakland. Y'all, we have a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. But I think that to keep talking about diversity of tactics and then to constantly bring up violence completely negates negotiation, it negates the sit-in, it negates anything else that we need to do in order to actually get forward.
All right. I'm going to take a little different tack here. I'm going to work with what I know. That's coming from the military and then coming from a working class family, very simple family. I'm new to activism. I'm learning things all the time, relearning, reanalyzing what's going on. And so if I sound like a simpleton, it is in fact because I am. I think Oakland is easily one of the most radical cities in our country. If you're like me, perhaps you came to Oakland because of that, or you stayed in Oakland or the Bay because of that. I think we like being here. It's productive for us personally in our ambitions. But then we fall into this trap of preaching to the choir, and we preach to the choir so much. So the more we learn, the more we teach each other, the more difficult it is to relate to the rest of the country. I've got two working class parents. My father was a log truck driver, a mechanic, and then a small business owner. My mother was a small business owner. My father didn't graduate high school. I joined the military. I saw what we were doing. And I turned down a $70,000 reenlistment bonus as well as my pay and benefits to get out of there because I couldn't stand for it. So in this movement, I joined it because I saw it as an extension of my existing activism against the government corporate corruption of the defense industry. And so that's widespread. You know, I think the government provides these essential social services that help level the playing field for the inadequacies of our capitalist culture. And so that leaves the left to be very hesitant to speak against the government. And so the right, they have this tendency to value, you know, individual ambition, entrepreneurial spirit. And so then they leave big business alone. They don't want to mess with big business. And so then they attack government. The elephant in the room is that they're one and the same. So I think we've got so much to agree on, but here we are back and forth talking about tactics when we need to address what we want. Do we want a popular movement or do we want a progressive movement? I think the past, you know, 40 years have shown, or 30 years, have shown the inadequacy of progressive movements. I think we've got the potential for a broad-based movement here, to work with what we do have in common, to really, you know, get at the inherent problem at the top. There's a very small contingency of this country that desires revolution. Coming from my military background, I do not believe the civilian population is well suited to resist or, you know, to fare well if things got really violent. I've seen what the military can do. I've seen what we have at our disposal. And once that turns on the civilian people, it's going to get nasty. You know, all these kids that spout revolutionary rhetoric, you know, I think about dead children, dead women, dead families. It's going to get ugly. And so I really want to avoid that at all costs, you know. Revolution is... While, you know, the end is great, the means are horrible. When it comes to diversity of tactics, of course, we need to be diverse with our angles. But I heard this lecture, this guy cited this advisor to Martin Luther King. And he said, don't go out there and march like you enjoy marching. Go out there and march like you're trying to communicate something to the public. That is your audience. You know, we're all, I'd say that Bay Area is higher than average in their education level. We should understand ethos, pathos, and logos. You know, understand your audience and really cater to them, because otherwise we're shooting ourselves in the foot and we're further isolating ourselves in our, you know, devolving circle. Excuse me real quick. I think that, you know, a lot of property destruction and whatnot, that's the thing. It's not easily understandable. My family, my friends, my non-political and apolitical, they're very much in support of the Occupy movement. Everybody's suffering, and, everybody is part of this 99%. But I think as long as we continue to move forward with our progressive movement tactics, we're further isolating folks. So when it moves on into the diversity of tactics, I know some will say that yes, it's part of the organization of the movement. You know, they agree on these diversity of tactics, but that is fairly disingenuous unless you're publicizing to the public that you're requesting to be at your events and your actions. If you're not publicizing that, yes, we are going to destroy things, then that's disingenuous to the people you're trying to reach. So, thank you.
Can you hear me? How about now? How about now? Okay. So just a quick disclaimer. What I'm about to say is for intellectual and entertainment purposes only. I do not at all advocate any... What I'm about to say is for intellectual and entertainment purposes only. I do not at all advocate any illegal action. I do not advocate any illegal action, violence against the forces that oppress you, or organized insurrection against the state and capital. Violence is when a mother is denied food stamps and feels as though she has no option left but to shoot herself and her two children. Violence is when the police beat and kill youth of color in Oakland. It is when immigrant families work three jobs to sustain themselves and their relatives abroad, when the military spreads democracy in Iraq and Afghanistan with stealth bombers and drones. Violence is the modern-day slave labor facilitated by the prison system. It is the slow, insidious havoc that the court system wreaks on the lives of those who have the wrong skin color or can't afford a good lawyer. But violence is also when we fight back. It is a tool to get what one wants or needs, one of the oldest and most effective tools. Violence can be an intense form of care and love, the material expression of our passion for freedom and each other. These days, what gets labeled violence is that which is outside of or against the law, when people take matters into their own hands. One example of this you can see just from the port blockade, which Gene Kwan called economic violence against the city of Oakland. I think we all know what actually constitutes economic violence. Mm-hmm. If we are here to talk about strategy or tactics for the Occupy movement, then it's necessary to point out that this framework begs the question of what exactly we are strategizing for. Whether one subscribes to one of the simplistic paradigms of nonviolence or diversity of tactics, one does that with a goal in mind, whether that is simply the continuation of the movement as such and our navel-gazing role as activists in it, or the movement's transformation into an anti-capitalist struggle. I'm interested in fighting for a classless, stateless world where we can organize our lives as we please, free of the shackles of wage labor and oppression based on our gender, race, or sexuality. More specifically, I'm not utopian, but rather struggle for the destruction of all prisons and the prison-like social relations that bind us together. I'm not interested in fighting for abstractions like justice, accountability, or even peace, just as I'm not interested in reforming this disgusting system. We already live under the state's version of peace, and I'm not convinced that the activist version would be much better. To understand the Occupy movement, we have to look at the larger context. It's the current expression of the cycles of struggle that have resonated across the globe over the past few years, from the Greek insurrection of 2008, to the Arab Spring, to the riots in England, none of which were nonviolent. These struggles have many common threads, some of the most prominent being an insurgent anger against police violence enacted on poor, mostly non-white communities, as well as a reaction against the contemporary expression of the austerity state, which we see here as budget cuts and massive unemployment. The Occupy movement is the beginning of a movement against austerity, and of course it will take the forms dictated by our material and social conditions. In post-industrial cities like Oakland, where many of us are essentially a surplus population or work in forms of precarious or part-time labor, the struggle ends up taking the form of homeless people, students, the unemployed, activists, and even workers coming together in the streets. Right now we see a middle-class workforce becoming dispossessed, proletarianized for the first time. And just like in Wisconsin, people are beginning to fight back. The Occupy movement has been largely started, at least in the activist sector of it, by white middle-class people. And these upstanding citizens who often compose protest movements want to retain the privileges that have already been stripped from so many. This class composition manifests itself in the movement's approach to violence and its tendency to use constitutionalist language and declare the cops as part of the 99%. It is an inherently privileged position to proclaim the cops as your ally, or even to resist nonviolently, which many people don't have the opportunity to start from when they've faced police violence their whole lives. While so-called nonviolent tactics are important, and indeed mass collective struggle should be a focus, it's most effective when paired with defensive and offensive violence against those who would stop us from reclaiming the commons, our homes, etc. Also, if you study moments of unrest throughout history, such as 1968 from Mexico to France and across the world, or 1977 in Italy when workers took over their factories and struggled in the streets alongside students, or Oaxaca in 2006, or even the Arab Spring, you'll find all sorts of tactics being used in tandem with each other to great effect. A dogmatic nonviolence is not only ineffective, it is ahistorical. While it is good if we can successfully blockade the port, it is better if we can defend the pickets and barricades from the riot police. It is wonderful if we can occupy an abandoned commercial space and establish a social center for the use of the people, but it is even more powerful if we can stop the sheriffs from evicting us. I'm not arguing for a symmetrical war or full-scale military conflict, but rather the use of diffuse asymmetrical warfare as our situation warrants. We can and should use all of the means at our disposal in the creation of zones free from police control and outside the dictates of capital. What was liberating and exciting about the Oakland Commune, which is what some people call Occupy Oakland, wasn't that we were sitting at yet another protest in a cold, muddy park in the middle of a dirty city, but rather that it was the creation of a space that at the same time served our own needs, allowing us to provide for one another, and was in direct conflict to capitalism and the forces of the state. Unlike other occupations around the country, we took a confrontational stance against the police from the very beginning, making a habit of chasing them out and chanting each time they came into the plaza, saying, "Pigs, go home." This allowed many people who would have been alienated by a police presence or collaboration with the cops to participate in the occupation, as well as stopping the daily police harassment of homeless folks who sleep in the plaza. I'm about out of time. I have a lot more I wanted to say, but I'll just finish quickly by saying that if what we really want is a radically different society, then we must expect that it will take an intensity of struggle to achieve it. We cannot simply sit down or appeal to authority. We must become students of revolt, and much as we can avoid, and avoid as much as we can the pitfalls of the past politics. Any strict ideology or dogma will only hinder us, whether it is nonviolence or a fetishization of violence. Instead, let's work together to resist and discover how much we are capable of.
Word.
Thank you. Well, I'm so happy we're actually having this discussion and this debate. And for me, that's one of the reasons that I'm reluctant to accept a framework of diversity of tactics, because my experience being involved with the anti-globalization movement, which I actually prefer to call the global justice movement, for something like 10 years, was that once we accepted diversity of tactics, we actually stopped discussing both tactics and strategy. And for me, one of the most important words in a framework of strategic nonviolence is strategy, which I don't think we have. If we have a strategy, then we can figure out what tactics make sense. In that way, I think we do certainly need a diversity of tactics. But when diversity of tactics becomes a code word for anything goes, let's not talk about it because we just don't want to tell anyone what to do, which I don't think is what any of you are advocating here, but has been the way it kind of seemed to come down a lot in the movements I've been in, then I think we lose intelligence and we lose that ability to actually confront each other, challenge each other, and tangle with these issues, which are complex and not easy to resolve. For me, I think the strategy has to begin by recognizing that violence is endemic in the system we live in. Poverty is a form of violence. Racism, gender violence, all of those things are immense forms of violence that do untold harm, cause untold suffering to people every single day of their lives. But they're also hidden. When you say violence, you know, if you say to someone who's a violent person, they might picture an anarchist in a black mask, you know, with the bomb, or they might picture someone of a different race with a gun, but they very rarely picture a white man in a business suit who's probably making the decisions which are causing far more suffering than anybody else. So the strategy of nonviolent resistance and what we sometimes call the people power strategy is that we make the hidden violence in the system visible by contesting it. That the system can continue to inflict that violence because in some sense we all consent to it. We all comply with it. We often feel like we don't have a choice. We might not see the choices we have, but our lives are so entwined with it that to eat and to feed our kids and to pursue our goals, we do what the system requires of us. And when we stop doing that, when we withdraw consent, then oftentimes the system responds with that violence, which then becomes visible. When the system has to use violence to maintain itself, it's very costly. It's costly to the system in terms of money, in terms of effort, in terms of energy, and also in terms of legitimacy. And I would say our strategy is not about asking for our legitimacy. I agree, we don't need to do that. Our strategy is to make visible the illegitimacy of the system that we're in and make that clear to people. I think our strategy is also in the Occupy movement right now to build as broad a movement as is conceivably possible. And in that, we have in some ways done an amazing job, and in other ways, as you can see, we are just at the very beginnings of figuring out how to actually bring together that 99%. Kazo in one of our emails said, The trick right now is not about bringing down the 1%. I think they're actually doing a good job of that themselves. It's how to unify the 99%. So in that, I think a strategic nonviolence, again, right now for the Occupy movement, not necessarily all the time, everywhere, under any circumstances, for every social movement or revolution everywhere, but right now for the Occupy movement, is a nonviolent strategic resistance, because that way we make the illegitimacy of the system much, much clearer. We also make clearer to people what we're going to do when we get together, so that people have a choice. They're empowered. If I know what's going to happen in an action, I can make a choice about whether I want to participate. If I go to an action thinking that we have agreements and people start doing stuff that I didn't sign on for, then I'm disempowered and I don't have a choice. And I don't think we build a movement by disempowering people. I think we build a movement by empowering people, giving them choices and giving them radical choices that encourage them to step out of their comfort zone and do something that they have never done before. And I think that has been one of the great strengths of the Occupy movement, that so many people have come into it who have never been activists before. It's also one of the huge challenges. You know, I've sometimes said it's a movement composed really of raving drunks and former student body presidents, right? Yeah, right. It has a spread of, you know, immense, like, different cultures, different challenges. Trying to figure out how to get us all to work together, I think, is a major challenge for us right now. So having agreements, keeping to those agreements, and having these discussions, I think, is part of how we built that movement.
Could we have a round of applause for all the panelists?